Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Andy Gosler, Professor of Ethno-Ornithology at the University of Oxford and an ordained minister in the Church of England. He shares some of his fascinating story in this great new book, Coming to Faith Through Dawkins. Andy, one of the things you said about Dawkins' writing was that it ironically made you begin to think about God, but you were also beginning to get dissatisfied. You've already touched on the fact that there were philosophical flaws. People later came to see that there were scientific flaws. I mean, what were some of those flaws that really struck you and that helped you to grow dissatisfied with his work and with some of the theories that he was proposing in his work?
Yeah, so... The main flaw that I saw in The Selfish Gene, the philosophical flaw, was that the whole book is an argument for genetic determination. It's saying, you know, you are what your genes made you, and there's nothing you can do about that. Now, there are all sorts of problematic consequences of such a belief, such as moral responsibility. Can we be held responsible for what we do? If, you know, we can say, oh, I'm sorry, I've got a gene that made me kill this person or rob Marks and Spencer's or, you know, whatever. So that's a problem that comes from that, but that's not the flaw in itself. The flaw is that having constructed this great argument for genetic determinism, the last page or so says, but it doesn't have to be like this. We can choose to defy the tyranny of our genes and be nice to one another. Well, apart from the fact that that is patently true, it totally undermines the rest of his book. Where does that come from? Are you saying we've got a gene for being nice to each other? In which case, we're not defying the tyranny of our genes. We're just doing what our gene for being nice is telling. You know, it smuggles in there, you know, smoke and mirrors, something that is just totally contradicting the rest of the book, but possibly the only bit of The Selfish Gene that is actually true, that is actually correct, that, yeah, we can choose to be nice to each other.
I guess as well, a lot of his work, you've pointed out various points of contradiction in his work. You talk a little bit about that in the book Coming to Faith Through Dawkins, but you also talk about, in many ways, his limitations on the way he talks about natural selection. What I'd love to know is, why do you think that natural selection, particularly the way that Dawkins defines it, is not the whole answer, in your opinion, when it comes to actually working out the origins of life?
Yes. So, I mean, the problem with If I can go back to Darwin, there's a tension, there's a conflict actually in the Origin of Species, which I became aware of at school. I thought, actually, I'm not sure that the process that he describes gives me the patterns that he describes. So the patterns that he describes are of the, which come, for example, from his belief that there were different species of finches on different islands in the Galapagos. That turns out to be problematic itself. But that was the idea, that you have different species in different places. And that's what we call allopatric speciation. And it reflects a local adaptation to local conditions. But the process that he describes, which is necessarily one of sympatric speciation because it involves the competition between individuals, and that competition drives a splitting of a population to become two separate species. Now, if I'm on an island 1,000 miles off the coast, I cannot be in competition with, you know, a bird 1,000 miles away. So how does local adaptation arise from this competition-driven model? We now know that there are physiological processes, and we know this from molecular biology, and we know this from the very science that Richard Dawkins implored us to do 40-odd years ago. Look at the genes. Look at the genes and you'll find it. And of course, people can now look at the genes. They can, you know, map a genome in 20 minutes or something, whereas they couldn't do it at all in 1976. And what they've discovered, and a whole new science of the study of how genomes are actually structured, genomics, teaches us that actually, and the physiology, the biology of epigenetics, whereby organisms switch genes on and off in response to what they need. They adapt themselves to their environment, right? And then down the line, there are other mechanisms that, okay, if this gene's been switched on for, you know, 7 generations or something, then I'm going to move it somewhere in the genome where I can access it more readily. Or vice versa, if that's been switched off, we'll sort of move that. And that's the science of genomics, is how organisms actually move chunks of DNA around. That's the big story of modern biology. It's that actually these adaptations, these so-called mutations, so any change in the genome is regarded as a mutation, comes about by this genetic engineering, this cellular genetic engineering by the organism itself. And that is the main process of adaptation, how evolution happens. And then, yeah, there may be some selection. But the problem with selection being the whole argument is that it's incredibly wasteful. You know, if the argument was that, okay, so you'd get a gene arising by a totally random process of errors, basically, and that if you then had strong selection, that gene would go to fixation. Well, for that to happen in a small population, okay, but we now know it happens in large populations, and the old mechanisms that were worked out and proposed in the 1920s and 30s are just not tenable for explaining the rapid evolution that we see today. Whereas this new process of organisms adapting themselves with or without selection is more dynamic, it's more responsive, it's less wasteful. You can have it in multiple individuals, you could have it in every individual in a population at the same time, right? You don't need massive selection for a gene to go to fixation. And of course, it explains the patterns that Charles Darwin described. So he was right that that was evidence for evolution, but it was evidence for a kind of Lamarckian evolution, which incidentally he accepted. It was the neo-Darwinists who said, no, 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 that's rubbish. And they did some really crass experiments involving mice that they claimed proved that Lamarck was wrong. You know, the rest is history. Now, for 150 years, and this is where it can start to get a bit personal, but for 150 years, we were taught categorically the Darwinian and the neo-Darwinian model of evolution. That's how it happens. And, you know, live with it. And of course, Richard Dawkins has banged that neo-Darwinist drum very loudly. But it's actually wrong scientifically.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Well, I suppose there's one thing, as you say there, talking about the limitations, and, you know, perhaps there's truth to various things, but actually the limitations of the neo-Darwinian model. But that's one thing. But I know one of the things you talk about as well is it, not just its limitations, but actually the dangers of a neo-Darwinian framework when you sort of push it to some of its logical conclusions. I mean, would you say just a little bit about that as well?
Yes, and that's what I was alluding to when I said it starts to get a bit personal, because the neo-Darwinists, they believed then that the genetic change was random, and it was only after they discovered Mendel's work that the science of genetics sort of originated. So the neo-Darwinists, their contribution was to bolt the new genetics. It's very old-fashioned genetics now, you know, or very limited in its understanding, of course. But to bolt the genetics of the 1920s and 30s onto Darwin's framing of evolution. Now, where it gets dangerous and where it gets personal is that the Huxleys, who were great sort of proponents of this, from Thomas Henry Huxley on to Julian Huxley, who in 1942 wrote a book called Evolution, the New Synthesis. What came out of that was a political Darwinism that argued that actually we should be doing the selection, and we shouldn't just be selecting, you know, breeds of cats and dogs and horses and Buddleia. You know, we should be exercising natural selection or artificial selection on humans. And so the science of so-called science of eugenics originated. Now, Julian Huxley was a staunch advocate of eugenics. If you look on YouTube, you can find a film that he made, that he narrated, I think in the 1930s, about eugenics, and it is spine chilling, some of the things that he says. Now, as a Jewish person, I grew up with knowledge of the Holocaust. I was born in 1958, so, you know, not even 15 years after the end of the war. My parents didn't talk about it very much because it was very painful, but I learned later that half the Goslar family, all these cousins of mine in the Netherlands, had been murdered by the Nazis in 1942. And the Holocaust, you know, evolutionary biologists might, as they did when I got into biology, might like to distance themselves from those things. I mean, I was told as a student, oh yeah, do read Darwin's The Descent of Man, but don't read the stuff about the evolution of humans. Just read the sexual selection part. That's because it's a bit racist. Well, yeah, it is a bit racist. I mean, it basically comes out of the imperialism and the colonialism of the 19th century British Empire, which was good in parts, the British Empire, but not these elements of it, not the racism. And the Holocaust was eugenics. It almost certainly wouldn't have happened without the neo-Darwinists. I won't say without Darwin, because I always consider Darwin as an innocent in this. He was a naturalist and he loved nature and he just wanted to know what was going on. And the idea that other people would take his ideas and use it for political ends, I think would have mortified him, really. But this is, as I say, where it gets personal. And so when I read Richard Dawkins saying, well, you know, well, that's tough. I'm sorry you don't like the way that nature operates, but it is the way nature operates. Then when we discover that actually it's not how nature operates, and you are just banging the same racist, eugenicist drum, and your atheism just comes out of that, and because you think that evolution is just driven by competition rather than the need to adapt, you've constructed a theology that, well, if competition drives life, then the God who created life can't be the God of the Bible. But as I say, competition doesn't drive life. It drives empires. But it's not what underpins biology.
So how do we tell a better story? How do we correct that narrative that is so ingrained, not only in the academy, but has definitely infiltrated into, you know, the normal sphere of influence that everyone is kind of believing?
I think we come at it as I think we get a sense from the book. I'll wave that. That we come at it from multiple angles. There is a better story being told in biology. And I think it's important that comes out. Rather than competition, what we see as ecologists, as physiologists, as even, you know, cell biologists, is the cooperation within nature. Right from the perception that subcellular parts, you know, organelles like mitochondria and chloroplasts in plants were probably independent organisms that realized, if you like, inverted commas, that actually they'd have a better existence, more sustainable, if they lived within a larger cell and there was the cooperation. From that to the mycorrhizal associations with plants, that the vast majority of flowering plants, you know, over 99% of flowering plants need an association with fungi, with their roots, to increase the surface area. They feed the fungus. The fungus gives them a larger surface area so that their roots operate, and even allows them, possibly, jury's out slightly on this, the so-called wood wide web, but some communication between trees and between plants through their fungi, maybe. But that intense cooperation. And again, you see it with, pollinators and with seed dispersers, you know, the birds that, you know, eat fruit. So you can take a neo-Darwinian reductionist perception and you can say, oh, well, the bee pollinating the flower, well, it's just using the flower. You know, it's not interested in pollination. Yeah, probably isn't. It's only interested in the nectar. And the plant is only interested in, you know, getting its pollen dispersed. And it's in the interest of the plant that those bees are specialists, because you don't want your pollen wasted on other species of trees, you know. So that sort of generates specialization, but specialization turns out to be more efficient in many ways anyway. But that intense cooperation, you can look at it and say, oh, they're just using each other. Or you can step out and say, oh, but this is a mutualism. This is a mutual dependency between these two organisms that actually they couldn't function without the other. Similarly, fruit dispersal by birds. You can say the bird's just using the tree. Yeah, sure, it is. Yeah, and it's going to nest in it, and that's fine. But actually, there's a mutual dependency between them. And the more specialized they get in terms of their diet and their dependent, then the more dependent they are on each other. Now, what is mutual dependency if it's not love? Is that not another way of thinking of love? I think of my own marriage, and I could construe that as a mutual dependency. And so I see that as running right the way through nature and up to Gaia, the extraordinary and I think pretty well proven Gaian mechanisms that maintain a stable climate if we will but let it. You know, so that's a different story. And actually, to paraphrase Darwin, in his last paragraph, his famous last paragraph, he said there is a grandeur in this view of life. But I think there is a grandeur in this view of life. There's a greater grandeur in this view of life when you recognize that the tangled bank that he described operates more through mutual dependencies, cooperations, than through competition. And that is generating diversity.
And one of the examples you use is of the honey guide. Would you say a little bit about that? Because it's such a beautiful example of exactly what you were talking about just there, Andy.
Well, yes. So the honey guide is the greater honey guide is an African species. It's found in many countries, but it has a mutualism with humans, and it does seem to be specifically with humans. So it has a number of behaviors which are specifically for guiding humans to bees' nests. And when people find the bees' nests, because they then smoke, and this is why humans rather than other animals, is that humans have mastered fire and they can make smoke to sort of tranquilize the bees, and they can break open the nest, and they'll leave a bit of the honeycomb for the honey guide. So that's a little thank you. And this dependency may go back thousands of years. Almost certainly does go back many thousands of years. And one just wonders when it evolved, how it evolved. The greater honey guide seems to have a number of other adaptations, physical, anatomical, or morphological adaptations for resisting bee sting, for example. And you just wonder whether this was a co-adaptation, that humans discovering fire whenever we did, or proto-humans, whatever, led to the development of this guiding behavior. And how it kind of works is that when somebody wants to be guided, they use a particular call or whistle or click or whatever to attract the honey guide's attention. And then it gives various calls and behaviors, but it can work the other way around. The honey guide can decide, right, I want some honey, and can find someone to lead. And of course, there's a whole culture around this. There's a sort of a multi-species culture around this. There's the culture of the bird leading the humans, but also the culture of the humans knowing how to interact with the bird, and folklore such as in a number of cultures, that if you don't leave the honeycomb for the honey guide, the next time it's going to lead you to a lion. So, you know, so there's a moral twist to this, you know, and there always is a sort of moral something behind mutual dependencies. You know, you've got to honor that relationship. If you if you betray that relationship, then there's a problem, as politicians often find out.
As always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.